Greetings and welcome to the first Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard and I'm the book review editor for the JSR. Today, I am pleased to have joining us Professor Paul Harvey from the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Author of numerous books, articles, and edited volumes, Professor Harvey has become a fixture in the world of American religious history. He gained an even broader audience when he founded the Religion in American History blog at usreligion.blogspot.com. Also, his 2011 book, Through the Storm, Through the Night, A History of African American Christianity, will no doubt become a fixture in college classrooms across the nation. But Professor Harvey got his start writing about religion and race in the American South. His 1997 book, Redeeming the South, and his 2005 book, Freedom's Coming, have become standards in the field. Professor Harvey returned to this subject in his newest book, Moses, Jesus, and the Trickster in the Evangelical South, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2012. In it, he identifies the historical literary archetypes that he believes provides insights into the complicated and convoluted world of Southern evangelicals. I am pleased to have Professor Harvey with us today to talk about the book. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, before we get into the book itself, I want to talk about its origins. This came out of your 2008 contribution to the Lamar Lectures in Southern History at Mercer University. Can you talk about that experience and what sort of response you received there?
Yes, it was actually a very warm and wonderful experience. My friend Sarah Gardner is a very fine Southern historian. She teaches that in the history department at Mercer, and she was the one who had originally invited me. And I was very eager to accept because I had a number of ideas I was working through in my mind that I thought could be used as public lectures. It also happens that one of my best friends from college, Bill Underwood, is now president of Mercer University. And it gave me a chance to hook back up with Bill and just kind of catch up on our lives over the last however long it's been since I graduated from college, 30 years or something. I also was there, as it happened, by accident on the evenings of November 3rd and 4th. And my last lecture, which is now chapter 2 of this book, was given the evening that Barack Obama was elected president. So that was, we had a big election viewing party. I skipped the last few pages of that lecture, in fact, because I sensed that the audience was kind of eager to get to their television. But there were very nice audiences, wonderful responses. A lot of students had read my books, and some of them had thought I was an African American, which I'm not. But I kind of took that as a compliment, just as in terms of what I've tried to do about race and religion in the South.
I will confess, I thought you were an African-American, too, at first. So
that was
a surprise to me when I looked at your website for the first time when I was in graduate school.
But let's, blonde hair, blue eyes.
Right. Well, let's move on to the book. So you have these four archetypal characters, Moses, Jesus, the Trickster, and Absalom. Why did you settle on these characters? Moreover, what do they represent, and what do they tell us about Southern evangelicals?
Moses and Jesus are fairly obvious, of course, and the idea there is Moses was, of course, central to African antebellum African-American Christianity. That's sort of a well-known story of the Exodus story. And I had been working with my co-author Edward Bloom on a book about Jesus in American history, and so I'd already been doing some thinking and writing about Jesus. So in some ways, this was a chance to kind of start to try out some of those ideas. In 2005, I taught a class on Faulkner and Morrison, and in that class, we focused mostly on Absalom, and Beloved. And later on, with the same co-teacher at my university, an English professor, we taught Edward Jones's The Known World, and I began to piece together kind of a story of how the Absalom story had been passed down through Southern literature, starting probably before Faulkner, but certainly created by Faulkner as a classic of American literature. And so I inserted Absalom mostly because it came really right out of that class. In fact, that part of the book is more or less just notes from my class that I wrote up kind of formally. So it was very exciting to have my teaching and research come together like that. And then The Trickster is something I'd long been interested in because he shows up so much in Southern folklore, all kinds of trickster stories, trickster tales. And the trickster in general, of course, is a kind of universal human character showing up in particular guises in the South. And so I had this idea of Moses, Jesus, and the trickster, and then Absalom as a kind of fourth thing, more of a literary device. And that's how I came up with the title.
Well, that's interesting. I'm struck by the elasticity of these narratives as I was reading. Moses, as you already said, is part of these black liberation narratives, but is also part of Confederate identity through Stonewall Jackson. Not to get too Freudian here, but I'm wondering if you think that these narratives reflect the people who hold them, or do you think there's something more going on with these stories?
I think both. You had asked me before, I think I forgot to answer, about what these characters represent and what do they tell us about Southern evangelicals. So one thing they tell us, perhaps not surprisingly, is that people take biblical, literary, and folkloric characters and mold them to their own ends, much as, you know, man creates God in his own image, that sort of famous idea. And there's certainly plenty of that in the American South, as there is elsewhere. But I also think that there's a lot more going on than that, because the stories are not infinitely elastic, and some stories work better than others. I try to make some arguments in my book that would not be obvious to readers. So people know about the Exodus story, and I do go into that for African Americans. I do go into that a little bit. But I wanted to talk about how the Moses story was adopted by white Southerners as well, and how white Southern military figures and so forth could become attached to, in Stonewall Jackson case or in Robert E. Lee's case, to sort of Christ-like figures, and how white Southerners understood themselves to be part of a sort of captivity narrative. Now, the fact is, in the long run, that story doesn't capture the American imagination in some way, because it just doesn't ring as true as the African-American Exodus story. And so what I wanted to talk about there is the way in which white Southerners adopted these stories, but they remain sort of internal to their culture. They don't become a kind of cultural icon like the African-American Exodus story. I also talked a lot about how African-Americans adopted Jesus centrally. I did a keyword search on the lyrics of spirituals, which you can do now because all the spirituals are sort of databased online. And Jesus basically shows up as much or more as Moses does. And most of the literature about the spirituals has to do with Moses' central place and how Moses becomes a kind of Christ-like figure. And I wanted to say something very, very different about that. Now, as far as the trickster goes, the trickster by definition cannot be created in one's image, because the trickster is always a kind of outlier figure. And people are always talking about how things happen to them in their lives that they have no control over, and that they do things that they did not want to do, much as Paul talks about in the New Testament. And I thought that the trickster is a kind of symbol for how our desires and our actions do not always come into accord with one another. And so some of that is kind of universal, but certainly it's not anything that where people are adopting a character in their own image. What they're saying is, they need a symbol for how they need a symbol for how what they're doing is not what they expected to do, or the kind of lives they're living are not the kind of lives that they expected, or how something has just sort of come over them suddenly. Okay, and then finally, the Absalom tale, much like the trickster tale, it's a literary figure of overwhelming power about how, again, we don't really control our own lives, and that there are these sort of grand themes of history that we fall into and that we inevitably enact, stories that we sort of must do.
Well, let me kind of continue with the Absalom character, because that was a very interesting one. Of the archetypes that you picked, you used fiction, as you already mentioned, Faulkner, Toni Morrison, and Edward Jones. Why do you think literature was particularly effective in allowing you to address this this narrative?
Because the Absalom story is one of the most powerful literary devices of the Old Testament. A father killing, sort of inadvertently killing his son, all the Freudian things, all the Jungian themes, all the sort of grand themes of human struggle and human desires that play into that. It's interesting to me that the Absalom tale is not particularly found in Southern folklore, Southern music, the other kinds of sources, sort of low culture sources, if you will, that I talk about. It's very much a literary device. And I think it's a literary device because it speaks to literary themes of how man is entrapped in worlds that in which he must enact certain kinds of roles. If you go back to Oedipus Rex or any of the classics of Western literature, so much of that is about that. And I think that's why it's so attractive to Southern writers as well.
Very good. Yeah, just to go along with the sources, you use literature, obviously, but you do use music and the arts alongside more standard historical material like sermons. What do you think some of these arguably non-traditional sources allowed you to say that you wouldn't have been able to say with more traditional sources?
Well, one thing is virtually everything in the trickster tales comes out of what you might call non-traditional sources. I use an awful lot of lyrics of music, and I talk about figures. Other scholars have done this with blues characters who are very self-conscious about depicting themselves as trickster figures themselves, or the blues as a kind of abstraction is personified. Woke up this morning, blues falling down like hail, that kind of thing, or blues talking to you as a kind of person or as a kind of figure. I also talked a lot about that with white musicians as well, and the ways in which they deal with thinking of themselves as trickster figures. Or I talk about the converse of that with Hank Williams, who had to create an alternative persona in order to sing religious music because he knew that the way that he conducted his own life, he could not carry out the religious music that he wanted to sing because of his alcoholism, because of his misbehavior and all that sort of thing. So he had to create a different kind of character, a kind of anti-trickster, if you will, in order to sing religious music. One of the other sources I talk about a lot, especially in chapter 3, is folk art. And I dealt a lot with researching the lives of folk artists, Anderson Johnson, Clementine Hunter, I just lost the name of the third one. Anyway, figures, especially in African-American art, who are learning to envision Jesus in their own image. And this is long before there was anything that we would now call black theology. So one of the arguments there is folk art allows African Americans to re-envision Jesus long before there is any kind of formal theological apparatus by which people start to do that more self-consciously or more in a more formal written kind of way. And so I go into that in quite a bit of detail at the end.
So this is, I'm assuming then, a preview of, you've already mentioned this, the co-authored book that you have with Ed Bloom, entitled The Color of Christ, the Son of God, and the Saga of Race in American History.
So we're coming out in September.
So coming out in September. So we're expecting to see more of this?
Yeah, this was a kind of warm-up for it. As it happens, very little from this book will show up in The Color of Christ. A couple of paragraphs are transferred over. For one thing, the latter book doesn't have a separate chapter about the South, and so this is more taking some of the same kinds of themes that show up in The Color of Christ, but really just focusing it as a regionally specific kind of analysis. And I go into great detail about quite a few aspects of folk art or music that simply just don't appear in The Color of Christ, because that's, you know, from 1500s to the present, covering all of America. So obviously we don't have time to go into the same amount of detail. So this allowed me to develop it just with that kind of Southern theme.
Very good. You confess in the opening pages of your book that this is a, quote, throwback to an earlier kind of religious history that centered on Protestantism and marginalized other traditions. What led you to make this editorial decision, and what do you hope to accomplish in directing your focus like this?
A couple of things. One is there's so much writing in recent American religious history about pluralism and about the importance of pluralism and all these sorts of diverse, what I call diverse co-equal traditions that are competing for space in America. Now, I'm about to embark on a writing of kind of a new religious history of the South for University of Chicago Press. So I'm actually going to deal with that issue in a lot in there. And I'm going to talk about how there's this very long, what I call pre-evangelical history of the South. And in some ways, I think in the future of the South will go back to its origins as a kind of more, much more of a pluralist region. But in the interim, there was about a 200-year period of evangelical dominance. And to suggest there that there are these diverse co-equal traditions, as I say in the book, it's just flat not true. It's just not true at all. And so I think if we're going to look at that particular period, let's say from the late 18th century to the late 20th century, with historical honesty, you know, we have to talk about there is one religious tradition that clearly dominates everybody else. Doesn't mean that there's others, and doesn't mean that there's not lots of stories that could be told about the others, but I really wanted to focus on the dominant one because they were the people who had power.
Very good. Boy, that really hits up against some other book I know about that seems to stress.
Yes, exactly.
So what was the most interesting or surprising?
You're referring to your own excellent book.
I am referring to my own
Southern
book
Southern
because
Legends,
I can't stop plugging myself. What do you think was the most interesting or surprising thing that you discovered in researching this?
Oh, so many different kinds of things. One is I was surprised that I was so attracted to write basically literary analysis, in which is the last half of chapter one, is more or less a something that ought to be in an English professor's book. And I've never really, between that and between about half of chapter three, which deals with folk art, I've not written about literature and art in that kind of way, extensive way before. So I was rather surprised to find myself doing that, stepping pretty far outside of my historical training and doing so. So that's one thing that I don't know if I would say it surprised me. I don't know if it'll surprise the reader or not, but it certainly surprised me. The other part that was both interesting and surprising was looking at the legacy of folk art, as I've just talked about before, and looking at the way in which people were envisioning Jesus in all kinds of interesting ways in the late 19th, early 20th century, up through the 20s, 30s, 40s, when these folk artists mostly were working. And I really didn't know anything about that at all before writing this book. So that really just jazzed me. It was really interesting to research that.
Very good. Well, let's just end with this broad question. What do you hope readers are going to take away from this book?
I hope that they take away a couple of things. One is, even when we focus on the central tradition of Southern religious history, one of the main points of this book is religious, any kind of religious tradition, and this includes Southern, a powerful one like Southern evangelicalism, it ultimately can't answer all of our questions. And we look elsewhere for questions that are so difficult and that religious traditions often kind of throw their hands up, theodicy type questions. Why do good things happen to bad people? That sort of thing. And it's very difficult for religions to answer those kind of imponderable questions. And we have other literary figures, folkloric characters, music, art, dance, all kinds of other ways in which we come to terms with and grapple with those questions. I think people realize that in general, but I think our image of Southern evangelicalism is that it's such a pervasive and powerful presence that it sort of encompasses a worldview for people who are participating in that. And certainly Southern evangelicals tend to say that about themselves. But as a matter of fact, it's just simply not true. And the degree to which even devout evangelicals will turn to spirit worlds, will turn to tricksters, will turn to conjure men, will turn to music that deals with questions of ambiguity, questions of darkness, questions of why we do things that we don't want to do. I hope readers can kind of see how complex people's religious worlds are and how many different kinds of sources even Southern evangelicals draw from in comprising and in thinking about their religious worlds.
the center is far more complex than we think, right?
Exactly.
With that,
you know that.
Exactly, I do. With that, I think we should conclude this podcast. Again, the book is Moses, Jesus, and the Trickster in the Evangelical South. And we thank Paul Harvey for joining us today. Be sure to check out his website at www.paulharvey.org. And while you're at it, click on over to the Journal of Southern Religion at jsr.fsu.edu.
Journal of Southern Religion, yay!
Yay! We're in the midst of overhauling the website, and soon we're going to have a donation center. So if you like this podcast and want to hear more of them, please consider donating to the JSR. My sincere thanks to Paul for joining us today and to our technical director, James Garrity. Thank you for listening, and we'll be talking with you soon.
Thank you, Art.